This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The former commander of U.S. troops in Iraq has written a new book saying the things he couldn't say while he was in uniform. Retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez writes that the Bush administration led America into a strategic blunder of historic proportions, and that the executive branch of our government did not trust its military. He says there was a shocking lack of resources and proper training for our troops. His book is called Wiser in Battle. General Sanchez commanded the coalition forces responsible for all military activity in the Iraq theater of war during the year following major combat, from June 2003 till the end of June 2004. The insurgency grew, and the Abu Ghraib abuses happened during his command. He describes the end of his career as a casualty of Abu Ghraib. He retired from the military in November 2006 after serving 33 years in the Army. General Sanchez, welcome to Fresh Air. Is it fair to say that you think you were sent into Iraq with a non-existent plan?
Oh, absolutely. We have this extremely successful, probably one of the best offensive campaigns in U.S. military history. We convince ourselves that we have won everything that we care to see in the environment tells us that we have succeeded in changing this regime and that we can walk away just like we have done in the recent past. Examples are Kosovo and Grenada and Panama, where we're, especially in Panama, we go in, conduct regime change, and very rapidly extract our forces and turn over power to another government. So the recent past that we look at is reinforcing of this notion that the war is over. And the impact of that one May declaration is really what leads to this very catastrophic strategic mistake.
The mission accomplished.
The mission accomplished statement by the president, or the perception that the mission is accomplished when he makes his speech on board the aircraft carrier. I contend that most of the significant problems of the occupation period are caused or aggravated by the impact of that statement. And
how did it make your job harder?
Well, you have to imagine this scene. As I'm taking command on 14 June of 2003, the two higher headquarters that have been fighting the war are leaving. I mean, these two headquarters are literally shutting down satellite antennas. They're dismantling their command posts.
You're talking about Jay Garner's group and what else?
No. Well, I'll get to Jay Garner here in a second. I'm talking about General Frank's headquarters and General McKiernan's headquarters that are the two higher headquarters above my command and General Wallace's command. They are shutting down all of their operations, unplugging computers, satellite antennas, lining up their convoys, and leaving Iraq headed to Kuwait. That's the first real impact. The second is that on this around the 16th of April, before the president makes his appearance on the carrier, the orders have already been issued for the removal of the combat forces that are in the country. The units that had fought the ground war were told in April that they would be home by August, and no one wants to be the last man killed in this war. And then about a week after I assume command, General Franks comes to Iraq on his farewell tour before retirement, and he reinforces those orders and tells the units that they will be home before the end of the summer. Then you have Bremer and Garner. In May, Garner's organization, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, are celebrating with high fives when they find out that they're being replaced by Ambassador Bremer and the CPA. Bremer comes in with a very small organization, and literally all of the key people from Garner's organization leave the country. And along with them goes what little institutional knowledge had existed on a plan for standing the country back up. And then probably just as important, commanders at all levels and senior leaders are being removed by the Army and they're being sent back to the United States.
So you're basically saying most of the military infrastructure is moving out as you head in, and then the insurgency starts to grow, and you don't have the resources you need.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What happens to us is that we truly, honestly believe that this war is over at all levels of leadership. And the reality on the ground is very clear to me within a matter of a couple of weeks that we still have a war going on.
You complained to the Pentagon in 2003 in a letter that was later leaked to the Washington Post that your supply situation was so poor it threatened Army troops' ability to fight. What were some of the things you needed in terms of supplies, spare parts, body armor that you didn't have?
What we are facing during that period of time and what drives that letter is that we are having a very difficult time in reestablishing all of the logistics supply chains because they have been disestablished after the declaration by the president. And this encompasses the entire range of sustainability issues for our vehicles. Spare parts are very, very difficult to come by. And then at that time, we're also facing the challenges of a growing insurgency and the improvised explosive device phenomena that is creating some major vulnerabilities for us because our equipment was not designed for that kind of warfare. So those are the things that are driving us on the ground. And, you know, as we are adapting as we are learning the environment, and we're asking for that support.
You write in your book, "I saw the cynical use of war for political gains by elected officials and acquiescent military leaders. I witnessed those resulting political decisions override military requirements and judgments and in turn create conditions that caused unnecessary harm to our soldiers on the ground." And I think, you know, one example here is that you cite is rushing to hand sovereignty over to the Iraqis by July 1st, 2004, to do it in a few months instead of a couple of years, which was what was originally intended. And you say in your book that you think that that decision to hand over sovereignty by July 1st of 2004 was a political decision to help President Bush win the 2004 election. Why did you reach that conclusion?
In November of 2003, we have assessment teams that come into the country and establish the fact unequivocally that the military is executing a strategy that is accomplishing what is necessary in countering the insurgency. However, they also establish that the effort that we as a coalition are undertaking in rebuilding the businesses and providing jobs and rebuilding local, city, provincial governments, that is failing. It is very clearly established. And it is at that time that we are searching for solutions, and the solution is that we will transfer sovereignty. The military advocates over the course of the following months that maybe the timing isn't right because the capacities of the Iraqis has not been built sufficiently to hand over this extremely complex situation. But the decisions that are made are that we will absolutely not waver from that 1 July transfer sovereignty date. If, in fact, we execute and complete the missions in Fallujah, both against al-Sadr and against the insurgency in Fallujah in the April 04 timeframe, it is clearly recognized that we put at risk that transfer of sovereignty. We have no one to transfer sovereignty to at that point, and it will be seen as a failure of our strategy, which in turn would have a very adverse effect on the polls and on the ability of the administration to get reelected.
So I think what you're saying here is that turning over sovereignty to the Iraqis in July 2004 was a way to make a situation that was going badly look good.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we know that our political and our economic efforts are problematic, and you know, we have to turn this over. And then at one point, there's a thought that, well, maybe we ought to hand over responsibility to the Iraqis so that when this goes wrong, they are the ones that are held accountable.
Now, you say at a time when the U.S. was clearly occupying Iraq and Iraq was beginning a civil war, that the Bush administration was denying that we were occupiers, we were just liberators, and the Bush administration was denying that there was a civil war in Iraq. Did that make your job harder? The refusal, as you see it, of the Bush administration to acknowledge the language that was really defining what was going on in Iraq.
From a military commander perspective on the ground, even before we deploy, there is no question in the minds of the military commanders that once we arrive in the Middle East, that we have chosen as a nation to launch a force of 150,000 to 180,000 soldiers into the belly of the beast, if you will. We are going into a country that sees us as infidels. We are going into a region that is the home ground, if you will, of our radical extremist enemies in this global war on terror. We know that Iraq, from history, that they absolutely, adamantly oppose occupation by any foreign forces. But yet, in the run-up to the war, we're telling ourselves that we're going to call ourselves liberators and not occupiers. To us, the military, that is an irrelevant discussion because the facts are that we are occupiers. International law defines that very clearly. We accept that from a military standpoint, and we plan accordingly. The issue that creates problems for us is that the policies and the resources that have to be provided in the political arena to accommodate and to satisfy the responsibilities of an occupier at those levels are not provided to Ambassador Bremer, and that makes our job harder on the ground.
My guest is retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He led all coalition forces in Iraq from June 2003 through June 2004. His new book is called Wiser in Battle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He commanded the coalition forces in Iraq from June 03 to June 04. He's written a new memoir called Wiser in Battle. You write in your memoir that during the more than a year that you commanded the troops in Iraq, you witnessed a blatant disregard for the lives of our young soldiers in uniform. Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, the key one is Fallujah. In Fallujah, we launch into Fallujah with very clear military objectives and stated missions, and then we make decisions after it gets pretty tough. Fighting, which, by the way, had already been communicated to the administration and our political decision makers that this would be a very tough fight and that it would last 3 to 4 weeks. So we go into this battle with a very clear understanding that this is going to be bloody and that there will be, in fact, civilian casualties, and also that the enemy's strategic communications will be acting against us because we know that there is an Al Jazeera reporter in there. And when we make the decisions to back away from that fight after 2 days, we make that decision knowing that we will eventually have to go back into Fallujah to eliminate that safe haven. It encourages the insurgency, essentially gives them a victory. And I believe that that is the seeds of civil war that we ourselves plant in Iraq.
Whose decision was it to pull out of Fallujah?
Well, that's clearly a political decision. Ambassador Bremer is the one that communicates that to me, but it was made in Washington, and it unequivocally was approved by the president.
Now, you say that the military was told to withdraw. You would have liked to have stayed and finished the battle. You think withdrawing help build the insurgency and create a victory for the insurgents. What was the logic behind withdrawing?
Well, it was very clear. The logic was that we had to withdraw our combat forces because if we did not, then the governing council was going to collapse. We would then have no government to hand over sovereignty to. We would have lost the support of the United Nations, which was in the country at that point in time, trying to find and identify that transitional government that we would be handing sovereignty to. That is the political implication of the military accomplishing the mission in Fallujah.
If there wasn't such a rush to hand over sovereignty to Iraq, if the plan was maintained the way it was originally supposed to be, to wait a couple of years, 2 to 3 years, do you think the problem you're describing would have been avoided?
Well, actually, the interesting thing is, as I also describe in the book, at one point we are having this specific discussion with the Secretary of Defense, and he himself asks, what is so magic about 1 July? Or words to that effect. So he himself is questioning why it is that we have to abide by the 1 July timeframe when we have this major security challenge on our hands. And this is done in a video teleconference that we're holding at our level in preparation to go into a video teleconference with the president. He doesn't surface that concern or question when we go in with the president. But I believe, firmly believe, that if we had been allowed and we felt that we were only about 4 days to a week from being able to break through and eliminate the resistance in Fallujah, if we had been allowed, we would have not given the insurgency this moral victory, an actual tactical victory, and we would have once again recaptured the initiative and brought back some security and stability during that period of time that would have allowed us to once again have the opportunity to make political progress with the local governments and the national government, political government, and to try to reestablish the economic aspects of the country. Whether it would have changed the course of the war, very difficult to say, because we have never been able to take advantage of these windows of opportunity.
Well, the politics that you think were driving the decision was basically not so much the politics of Iraq, but the politics of the Bush reelection campaign.
Well, absolutely. It's all tied together. It's the need for us to have this major success in Iraq, this major political success that shows progress. And if you fail in that significant milestone that we have identified at that point about 5 months earlier, then it shows a failing situation or a complete lack of progress and are backing away from the political milestones that have been set by our leadership. And you can't afford to have that in the middle of a presidential election.
So if you don't mind talking about this, what was it like for you as the commander of the coalition forces in Iraq to start to increasingly feel that the Bush administration was making its decisions based on wanting to win the reelection as opposed to based on what was best for the war in Iraq or for the soldiers fighting that war? And here you are responsible for putting those soldiers in harm's way in the service of a war that you were becoming increasingly skeptical about, for a president whose motivations you are becoming increasingly skeptical about.
I think this is the culmination of that is when I'm given the orders by Ambassador Bremer to in fact withdraw under fire. And this is when we have the discussion.
This is Fallujah again.
This is in Fallujah when we have the discussion in his office that turns pretty vocal. And when I tell Ambassador Bremer and General Abizaid that if I'm forced to issue those orders, that I will resign, and they'll have to find another commander to issue that kind of an order to my forces. This surfaces a fundamental question and challenge for military leaders in wartime. It is at the point where politics begin to drive the decisions that are made in wartime, and they are not necessarily in agreement with the military necessity to achieve military victory. And this is when you have to as a military commander, make some very fundamental decisions about whether you continue to serve or whether you choose to resign. And the decision calculus that drives the individual military commander has many factors. And for me at that point in time, I felt that if I left command and resigned, then I would be putting my soldiers at further risk. And therefore, I felt I had to stay in command and continue because I felt that I had a very good understanding of the dynamics and that I could mitigate some of the impacts.
Retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez has written a new book called Wiser in Battle. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. His new book contains scathing criticisms of how the Bush administration led us into war and how it's conducted the war. He describes a lack of strategic vision and a shocking lack of resources and proper training for our troops. General Sanchez commanded all coalition forces in Iraq from June 2003 through June 2004. He retired in 2006. He's written a new book called Wiser in Battle. I want to get back to the question what it was like for you as the commander to send men and women into battle as you were becoming increasingly skeptical about the war and the president leading it.
When I came out of Iraq, I had lost 843 soldiers, and I had had over 7,000 wounded. But we understand as military commanders that we operate under civilian control. We understand that this is part of the strength of our nation and the strength of our Constitution, and we know that unless these orders are illegal or immoral, that we must comply. And what we do on the ground is what we can to attempt to mitigate the loss when assigned missions or when told, as we were told in Fallujah and with Muqtada al-Sadr, to not complete and achieve the objectives that we had originally been in search of. So for a commander, it is very difficult. And you mourn the loss of every one of your young men or women. And, you know, there comes a point in time where I think you have to make that decision to resign if, in fact, you believe that that is going to be of some value.
But you didn't.
To
you
your
didn't
organization.
Do that.
I did not reach that point.
It's That's not correct. Until very recently that you started in 2007 that you started speaking out against the war.
No, I think what I've done, and when I spoke out in October of 2007, the reason I spoke out, and if you've read anybody that has read the text of the statement that I make, it's that we must in fact surge beyond the military in order to be able to achieve victory, that we can't continue with a strategy that is focused solely on the application of military power. That in order for us to win, which we must in this case, we have to address these other issues. We have to address the diplomacy and get the region involved. We have to address bringing economic hope to the average Iraqi through jobs and additional businesses. And we've got to address the political challenges that the country faces to this day.
I'm really interested in what you think about the American military's reliance on private contractors during the war in Iraq. We've been reading about so many problems that the contractors have had and how they've handled aspects of security. Architecture, I mean, there's an article in the New York Times this week about how KBR, which was responsible, among other things, for maintaining the housing facilities for many of the soldiers in Iraq, is responsible for faulting wiring in some of those facilities,
right.
And several soldiers have been electrocuted.
Right.
Did the reliance on private contractors for many responsibilities across the board pose any problems to you as head of command?
Well, it is both a blessing and a curse, depending on who you look at, on which contractors you look at. We were very closely tied to the contractor support that we were getting in maintenance and logistics and communications, even in intelligence, as we all know. We cannot and could not have accomplished our mission without that contractor support. Where you really have the problems is in the Blackwater type forces that come into the country that are operating independently and that create havoc, if you will, on the streets, and you wind up with sometimes incidents that are questionable. And it is in those incidents where some strategic problems occur. I mean, it ties you right back to Fallujah. I mean, that was a major problem for me. We do Fallujah because of the four Blackwater individuals, as we all know.
These are the contractors whose remains of their bodies, their burned bodies,
yes,
were hung up on a bridge in Fallujah. Quite a horrible spectacle.
Yes. And it is those types of contractors who had no real oversight because they're working for the Department of State at that point, and the Department of State does not have the capacity to provide adequate oversight. We don't have the right communications, command and control linkages, if you will, that allow us to maintain visibility of the operations that they're conducting. All of that creates problems for the commander on the ground. And as soon as you put combat-type forces that are contractors on the ground, that are operating independently, you're asking for trouble, and we have found it.
My guest is retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He led all coalition forces in Iraq from June 2003 through June 2004. His new book is called Wiser in Battle. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He commanded the coalition forces in Iraq from June of 2003 for over a year. He's written a new memoir called Wiser in Battle. Let's talk about Abu Ghraib. The Abu Ghraib scandal happened while you were commanding the troops in Iraq. Abu Ghraib, which had been an Iraqi prison under Saddam Hussein, became an American-run prison for Iraqi prisoners while you were the commander. When the American military took over the prison, was it clear to you whether those prisoners should be treated with the protections of the Geneva Conventions or not?
Well, first of all, let me give you a broad perspective on Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is a disgusting, shameful incident that I have described as a strategic defeat for our country. And it occurs under my command. It was not condoned, tolerated, or encouraged by any order, direction, or policy of the command. And I believe that the Abu Ghraib pictures have blinded us to the facts and the root causes of the abuses that occur in Iraq and in a greater totality across the global war. There was never any question. There was a question for about a week while I was in command about what the status of our prisoners were. But that was ended by the third week in June when we issued clear orders that every detainee in Iraq would be handled under the Geneva Conventions. There was no question. The issue that we have is that at the national level, the interrogation policies of the administration, which eliminated the Geneva Conventions, had completely eliminated the foundations of all existing policies and training and understanding of how it is that our military forces or to conduct interrogation or tactical questioning operations. The Army had failed to issue any implementation instructions and policies or to provide necessary training for any of our soldiers that are involved in these operations and for our tactical units, which get involved in tactical questioning at the point of attack.
And you said that some of the interrogators at Abu Ghraib had come from doing interrogations in Afghanistan, where the Bush administration said that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply to the Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters who were captured in Afghanistan. So they were used to doing interrogation techniques that went beyond the Geneva Conventions, and you say some of them were applying them in Abu Ghraib.
Well, I mean, they're applying them in the Iraq theater. Mm-hmm. What happens to us? The Army doesn't only fail to issue initial implementation policies and instructions and training. In the winter of 2002, the Department of Defense knows unequivocally that the policies as they have been communicated to the military forces have led us down the path and we have abused and killed detainees in Afghanistan. And we fail as a an institution to address those issues. So by the time Abu Ghraib occurs, before we even go into Iraq, before we even attack into Iraq, this is well known. Every single deficiency and problem that is later identified in Abu Ghraib is already well known by the most senior leadership of the Department of Defense. And it's ignored.
Now, in September of 2003, you wrote a memo with the intention of clarifying what was allowable for interrogators, since you felt that there weren't clear guidelines that the military had issued. So in this memo, correct me if I'm wrong, things that came under the category of acceptable was exploiting Arab fear of dogs while maintaining security during interrogations, isolation, sleep management, yelling loud music and light control to create fear and disorient detainees, deception, including fake documents and reports, stress positions, such as forced kneeling for as many as 4 hours at a time. Were you confident that all those things were acceptable under the Geneva Conventions?
Yeah, absolutely. The lawyers within the command unanimously had reviewed all of these procedures, and they were absolutely confident that every one of the procedures, with the safeguards and the oversight mechanisms that we implement in those policies, would be within the constraints of the Geneva Convention.
What are the safeguards that you're talking about?
Well, we're talking about the actual development of interrogation plans, the actual oversight of the conduct of the interrogation, actual oversight by senior commanders, senior interrogators, the medical oversight of the conduct or of the actual responses of an individual that is being interrogated. So in sum, it was the development of those plans that would be reviewed at multiple levels, and in the second memorandum, they would be reviewed at the most senior, both military intelligence and legal levels of Iraq,
well,
and finally approved by me.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the second memo, which came about a month or several weeks after the first memo, some of the interrogation techniques that you said were acceptable were rescinded unless you personally approved them. And you had gotten advice from one of your lawyers that maybe these things really weren't acceptable under the Geneva Conventions.
No, that is not correct. That is absolutely not correct. What happens between the two memorandums, and by the way, the legal investigation that is conducted, because there's a very specifically focused legal investigation that is conducted in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib to establish the validity of the guidance, the legal guidance that is given in this whole chain of events, that investigation establishes that these two memorandums are in fact legally sufficient, that they are in fact within the bounds of the Geneva Convention, and that if applied as envisioned and documented in those memorandums, they would have prevented any abuses. Now, having said that, the difference between the first memorandum and the second one is driven by the fact that there is one lawyer at the higher headquarters in Central Command who questions whether the two techniques are probably too close to the line. My lawyers are adamantly of the position that those two techniques are clearly within the conventions and allowed. And my guidance at that point is, if we will achieve consensus with my higher headquarters, both in Central Command and in Washington, that these memorandums are acceptable by eliminating those two, then go ahead and do it. I don't want to have anyone that is not on board with these two. Even though you believe that these are legal, take them off the memo. And that's what we do. And at that point, everyone agrees, all the way up to Washington, that these memos are sufficient and that they are within the conventions.
The Army report about Abu Ghraib released in 2004, in August of 2004, didn't accuse you of directly instigating abuse, but the Army General Paul Kern, who oversaw the writing of the report, said in an interview that you wrote a policy which was not clear and that by doing so you allowed junior officers to conclude mistakenly that they were following an official policy as they stepped over a legal line. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the confusion that exists, you know, there's a bigger issue within Abu Ghraib. And let me try to describe it to you. Once again, as I mentioned earlier, we have been blinded by the pictures. What is actually going on in Abu Ghraib is two different issues. One, it's the MPs that we all know, Grainers and Fredericks and Englands and the others. They are engaged in the punishment of criminal detainees because they had rioted and they had threatened the MPs in the days prior. Those detainees were never subjected to interrogations. And the problems that arise from those MPs engaging in this punishment are driven by probably a couple of factors. One is that they had not been properly trained. We had sent them, these reserve component soldiers had been sent into battle untrained and definitely under-resourced because of the systems that our Army has that doesn't properly resource those units. And probably the most important aspect of this entire issue here, of this detention problem, is that at the time that these abuses occur, a team of 40 Army experts led by the highest-ranking military policeman in the country, in the Army, a major general, are physically in Abu Ghraib conducting their assessments and the review of my operations. And they come out of there on the 6th of November and give me a report that advises me about some of the things that we've got to do, some of the procedures that have got to be put in place, and some of the training that they have conducted, and we accept that report. These are the Army's, the nation's experts in detention operations, and they miss and they fail to recognize that our MPs have this problem. That's one of the aspects. Let me tell you where the confusion comes in that is not known. The confusion is in what has migrated into the country from Afghanistan. You have the CIA and the Special Operating Forces that are still operating not under my command, with the rules that are applicable to the greater war, which mean that the Geneva Conventions do not apply. And we have individual soldiers that have come from that theater of war, and they have brought back or brought with them that understanding of how interrogations are to be conducted. And this is precisely what my memorandums are trying to control. But even if we apply my memorandums and say they're applied completely, you still don't eliminate the problem because my guidance and my orders do not apply to the Special Forces and the CIA. And we identify problems in both of those organizations, and we communicate those problems to their headquarters. One, the Special Forces, they report to General Abizaid's headquarters, and the CIA, which is nominally under the control of Ambassador Bremer in the country, and back to Washington, that they have major problems.
What's it like for you now as a retired military leader to be watching the war as a civilian? Does it look different to you?
Well, one of the things that I have to be very careful with is that most of the information that I'm getting is what appears in the press. And having a very intimate knowledge of the complexity of the battlefield, the complexity of the decision-making processes, and all of the variables that go into decision-making and the conduct of operations in this environment. And in the dealing with our host country, I have to be very careful that I don't make my own judgments about what is happening or make state opinions with only half of the information. Probably the most difficult thing for me is that I continue to see a strategy, a national strategy, that is not fully resourced, that is not surged. And I know that that is prolonging this war and that it is, in fact, costing us in terms of lives and money and time. That is probably the most difficult thing.
General, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, Terry. Glad to be on. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Retired Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez is the author of the new book, Wiser in Battle. The new book, The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, documents a now-forgotten famous Victorian murder case. It's by Kate Summerscale, the former literary editor of Britain's Daily Telegraph. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
A dark night. A lonely English country house, a family sleeping behind locked doors, and then, within this closed circle, an act of murder most foul. It sounds like the plot of the classic Agatha Christie mystery, down to the detail about the renowned London detective called in to crack the case. Except, as writer Kate Summerscale argues, the Road Hill murder of 1860 was not an instance of reality mimicking fiction. Rather, it was the true crime that helped catapult British mystery fiction into being. Wilkie Collins, Charles Dickens, even Englishman wannabe Henry James were all inspired by the Road Hill case to turn out uncanny tales featuring shrewd children, nervous governesses, and most crucially, dysfunctional families whose every member has a secret to hide. In her intriguing new book called The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, Summerscale zeroes in on the Road Hill case not only as a source for the evolving mystery genre, or enigma novels, as they were then called, but also for the burgeoning science of detection itself. As Summerscale points out, words like clue and lead were just entering the Victorian vernacular around the time of the case. The famous detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher, who was summoned to Road Hill House, was just one of eight men composing Scotland Yard's fledgling detective force. The squad was created, Summerscale says, in response to urbanization and the sense that an ever-expanding London was becoming mysterious to itself. The murder Witcher set out to investigate was particularly grisly. On the evening of June 29, 1860, the Kent family, consisting of Samuel Kent, his second wife, Mary, and seven children, four from Samuel's first marriage, were tucked into their beds. Also sleeping in the house were a young nursemaid, a housemaid, and a cook. When the nursemaid awoke the next morning, she discovered that three-year-old Saville, who slept in a cot in her room, was missing. Eventually, the household was roused and a search got underway. Saville's body was found dumped at the bottom of a filthy outdoor privy, his throat slashed. All of England was swept up by the case, and popular suspicion centered, of course, on the nursemaid. But Inspector Witcher sniffed out the scent of evil even closer to home. The Kent family, as he described it in reports to his commissioner, was emotionally fractured. The parents doted on their younger children. The children Samuel Kent had with his first wife, who was rumored to have gone mad, were displaced. Witcher's eagle eyes locked in on 16-year-old Constance, Saville's half-sister. The nightdress Constance had worn to bed that evening was missing from the weekly laundry pile. Later, a bloody shift was discovered stuffed into the kitchen stove, but it too quickly vanished. Also curious was Constance's reaction to the frantic announcement of Saville's disappearance that fateful morning. Witcher reported that Miss Constance opened her bedroom door dressed, heard what was being said, but made no remark. On the strength of Witcher's hunch, another new word entering the language of detection, Constance was taken into custody and tried, but the case against her was too weak. Witcher left the courtroom a failure. He was mocked in the press as Inspector Watcher of the defective police and denounced in Parliament as representing the most dangerous aspects of this new creature, the detective, nothing more than a working-class snoop set loose to invade the refined Englishman's cherished domestic sphere and besmirch young ladies like Constance with his grimy fantasies. When Constance came forward and confessed 5 years later, Witcher had already taken early retirement from Scotland Yard. His discharge papers cited the cause as congestion of the brain. Summerscale, like the detective she celebrates, is an excellent close reader of detail, and her book conveys the oppressive dullness of daily middle-class Victorian life, down to the Spartan supper of bread, butter, and water consumed by the nursemaid on the night of the murder. The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher combines a thumping good mystery yarn with fine social and literary history. But to Summerscale's credit, she ends her book with a disturbing detail that reminds readers of the very real little boy whose murder sets so much else in motion.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher by Kate Summerscale.